Well, it's time to review the top political news of the week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us on this Friday, May 10th. We'll review the top state, national, and international news of the week with two guests from different perspectives. We'll talk about a gay marriage bill passing in the Minnesota House of Representatives. We'll talk about the hearing held in Congress this week on the Benghazi attack. And we will talk about a boatload of developments on the Wisconsin state budget. And we want to know what you want to talk about in our Week in Review at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. Very happy to have with us Daryl Mayfield, Instructor of Business Ethics, Diverse Cultures, and Other Courses at Upper Iowa University in Wausau. He owns the Bradley Mesh Consulting Group. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Glad to be with you this morning.
Thanks for joining us again. Also with us is Owen Robinson, columnist at the West Bend Daily News and blogger at bootsandsabers.com. Good morning, Owen.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning, Daryl.
Good morning, Owen.
Well, let's start with state issues. Governor Walker is pledging to increase school aid after state revenue projections show $500 million more in state coffers than originally thought. Looks like Republicans and Democrats are agreeing on this one. Owen Robinson, are you on board too?
No, I'm not, honestly. It's been a little bit disappointing, I think, to see the Republican legislature and Governor Walker himself go a little bit squishy as we move into this year. And I think it's a sign that we're coming up to an election next year, that they're softening on a lot of what should be relatively bedrock stances. And frankly, if the state government is taking in more money than they had planned to spend and more money than they had anticipated, then that money should go back to the taxpayers.
What do you think, Daryl?
I think that programs can always use a boost. The overall issue is, where should such a surplus, if in fact this is a surplus, be invested? What is or are our greatest needs right now, and where could the money be spent that will have the most positive impact? And those are certainly tough decisions. They're tough decisions not only in a time of economic downturn, but they're a tough decision basically any time I think government receives what has been called surplus revenue. Again, I think we have to look at exactly where did the surplus come from. And perhaps there is, I would agree with Owen, perhaps if there is a possible way to give homeowners, taxpayers, some relief, that is should be maybe part of the program also. But the tough decision, and that's why we elect our representatives, the tough decision to be decided is, where will we get pretty much the most bang for our buck? Will it be in investing in our schools? Will it be for putting that program or that money aside to do some other things?
Mm-hmm. Owen, why did you say that lawmakers were getting squishy in terms of trying to give more funding to education?
Well, to give more funding to education, it rests on the assumption that spending more on it will benefit. And Daryl brings up a great point. We do have to make hard decisions about where we're going to invest things. But I also think it's worth pointing out that this is a projected surplus over the next 2 years, and we see how projections change. But once you commit to spending the money, you've already committed to spending it, whether or not that surplus actually is realized or not. So I would encourage the legislature to be very, very cautious about spending money that's not actually in their pocket yet.
Let's talk about the Joint Finance Committee, very busy this week, voting on all sorts of different measures. Among those deals yesterday on residency rules, police, fire, and emergency workers would have to live within 15 miles of the city or county where they work. Governor Walker wanted to do away with all residency requirements, but that didn't happen. This would affect Milwaukee the most dramatically, as all city and school district employees have to live in the city limits. Daryl Mayfield, do you think residency requirements are a good or bad thing? Are you okay with this 15-mile radius thing?
I think that to answer that question, you have to look at a comparable system. And one of the comparable systems that we have working around the country is the council manager or city manager form of government. Whenever a council elects or chooses to, hire a city manager, city administrator, it's agreed that that particular person is going to live within the bounds of that community because the proposals that they're going to be putting on the table are going to affect the members of that community, and so they should have skin in the game. And that's the overall issue here, is whether or not employees that are working within the system within the municipalities are going to have skin in the game, because if they are going to have skin in the game, they realize how important it is for them to be involved in not only the political process, but involved in the life of the community.
Owen?
I think that, to Daryl's point, I think an argument can be made for higher-end officials within a government organization needing to have skin in the game, to live in the community, to have to live with the consequences of the policies they put forth. But I think that's really at the very upper echelon of most organizations. For your average mid-level bureaucrat or your police officer or firefighter, I mean, there's really no justification. I'd rather tax money being spent on the best resources and the best people for those jobs than worrying about whether they live across an arbitrary boundary.
Yeah. Any problem with the state telling communities what their residency rules should be?
I think there's certainly, and the Democrats have brought it up, there is an argument for local control here. I don't see this as, honestly, the biggest issue in the world, but there is also the argument that really should communities have the right to be able to tell people where they can live, or is that, especially when you have communities and counties and municipalities and school districts spending a tremendous amount of state tax dollars as well, we want to make sure that money is being spent efficiently on the best people and not just on the people who happen to be in the smaller talent pool of the boundaries of the community.
Anything further, Daryl?
I would agree with what Owen said about the state getting involved in any regulation that would require employees in a municipality or in a town, in a village, to have to live there. I think that is something that should be handled and can be handled at the local level. Again, I think if you look at not only, and Owen said we disagree here in terms of high-ranking individuals, I think everyone in an organization that works in a community is valuable. So I would simply say leave that decision up to the municipalities and the state, basically stay out of it.
Well, here's another local control type issue. No Wisconsin city could ban the sale of large sugary drinks, as was recently attempted in New York, under a provision that was added to the state budget yesterday. Republicans on the Joint Finance Committee succeeded in putting the prohibition in the state budget, despite objections from Democrats who say this is an infringement of local control. So a ban on big soda bans. Owen?
Well, and that was actually my Representative Strakota, who got that in there. Kind of came out of the blue. I don't think anybody saw that coming, but I think if you look at what's been happening around the country and around Wisconsin, you already see the cities of La Crosse and Madison starting to consider soft drink bans or different ways to control what people are allowed to purchase from a nutritional standpoint, if you will. And I think that it's important not only just from a freedom aspect of if people are spending their own money on own goods, why should the government be getting involved in whether they get a 32-ounce drink or a 20-ounce drink? I don't see that as the government's role. So I'm happy to see that being preemptively forbidden, if you will, from government intervening in that. But it's also an economic issue. If you have businesses that span across the state and they have to have different little nitpicky rules for different municipalities and different cities, it becomes very difficult to do business in Wisconsin. And so I think it's important that we have in those areas some very uniform rules of how we go to market with those things.
Mm-hmm. Daryl, what do you think?
I would agree with Owen. I think that there's a freedom issue there. I think what the decision makers have to parse is if, in fact, an industry such as the tobacco cigarette industry is actually including harmful drugs that can be shown to make individual addicted, that is one thing. It's another thing, however, I think, to decide that you need to go looking for a problem because you have a solution, which I think the next thing to that is, and hopefully we'll talk about it, is this individuals not spending food stamps on what's considered to be junk food. But again, I think that this issue is a solution looking for a problem. Currently within, and it's interesting, we're talking about spending the extra surplus on education in our schools. Currently in our schools, we are teaching children, we are teaching them to basically to eat healthy. If, in fact, we are doing a good job of that, then they will know not to choose a lot of sugary drinks. Not that they can't have them, but like anything, it must be done with moderation.
Well, let's talk about that that bill that would restrict the amount of junk food that could be purchased by people who are using food stamps. This bill by Representative Dean Cofford of Neenah would require people enrolled in the state's food stamps program to spend at least two-thirds of their monthly benefits on designated items such as milk, bread, and vegetables. They could spend the remaining one-third on any authorized food. But there's beyond the junk food, there's talk that this bill would treat organic milk, sharp cheddar cheese, brown eggs as a restricted items that could not be purchased on food stamps. Your thoughts first, Daryl, let's start with you on this legislation and what we are telling food stamp recipients they can or cannot purchase.
Well, I think, as I said earlier, this is another solution seeking a problem. The false belief is that in large numbers, people are supporting or buying, receiving food assistance, and they're not buying food choices of those who are providing the funding. So the individuals providing the funding want to make sure that certain choices are being made. Clearly, if the issue is healthy food, then where's the evidence or correlating information that shows that this is a problem? Why would a bill treat some healthy food choices as junk food, i.e. the organic milk, the sharp cheddar, the brown eggs, the gluten-free things that may be in these food? Well, perhaps if you wish to subsidize other food industry producers, then you designate some foods basically as junk.
Yeah, so what's the deal, Owen?
Well, and bear in mind that this is a bill that's gone through a couple different iterations, and when it first came out, it was Dean Cofford, I believe, his effort to, and I think rightfully so, that if the taxpayers are spending money for people to subsidize their food, then the taxpayers should be spending money on healthy items for them. And I think that's a valid argument to make. It's one we make with the, as Daryl mentioned, with the school lunch program that certainly First Lady Obama has been pushing through regulations, federal regulations around that program. So if the taxpayers are paying for it, I think we should be spending money on good food. But then once it got into the legislature, you saw many a good number of special interests on it, honestly, in a lot of the food industry and in the beverage industry, push back heavily on it, and we've seen it watered down to this two-thirds mark, which honestly, there's really no good way right now to even regulate that or to even track it, except at the store level. Now, I know there is coming in the next 1 to 3 years having a benefits card that recipients will have all their benefits on, and that way we'll have a valid tracking mechanism. I don't know how big of a problem it is, but I think it's a valid argument to make.
Yeah, but can you shed any light on that you could spend money on milk but not organic milk, on eggs but only white eggs, not brown eggs? What's the deal there?
Well, I think this is when you get into the difficulty of when you do regulate these things, and that it becomes very, very complex because there is no standard definition of quote-unquote junk food. I believe that this bill was geared towards trying to mirror the requirements in the WIC program, the federal program for women and children, and what they're allowed to purchase with that benefit, with a few exceptions. I think there's certainly area for improvement there. There's no reason why an organic egg isn't as healthy as another egg or healthier. So, but I think that's when you get into this sort of very detailed regulation, you end up with a lot of discrepancies like that.
Yeah,
I would agree with Lou Owen's last statement that what you're looking at is the oddity that comes in about the brown eggs and the organic milk reflects special interests. I notice, interestingly, there's no discussion about goat dairy. Most of the world drinks goat dairy. We know that it's good, it's healthy. For those that are lactose intolerant, it would allow them to drink it. But yet, in Wisconsin, I believe, is number three in the nation in producing goat dairy. But yet, we don't have any mention of that type of food product in this particular bill.
We will talk more about some other state issues, move on to national and international issues as well. As we continue talking about the news of the week, we'll welcome your input too at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guests are Daryl Mayfield. He is an instructor of business ethics, diverse cultures, and other courses at Upper Iowa University in Wausau, and Owen Robinson, a columnist at the West Bend Daily News and blogger at bootsandsabers.com. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's your views on the news after 4 o'clock during At Issue with John Munson. You can call in to talk about the stories in the news this week that mattered most to you. Your views on the news after 4. Well, you can call in and talk about the news of the week right now as we are talking with Daryl Mayfield and Owen Robinson during this edition of The Week in Review, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Denny in Marathon County is with us. Hello, Denny.
Good morning. I couldn't help but think of the more nutritional than thou attitude by legislators with the restrictions on what people can buy for food stamps. I think everybody maybe everybody doesn't know, all legislators get a per diem of $75 or $78 per day, something like that. I work in the downtown area. I see legislators in restaurants and taverns all the time. It seems to me only fair that if we're going to tell food stamp users what they can and cannot buy with food stamps, we should expect the same of legislators about how they spend their per diem. It would be a lot of fun to have some citizens decide for legislators what they could and couldn't eat.
All right. Should we do that, Owen?
Well, I think that's, for Denny, I think that's certainly a valid point. I think we'd like to see all our, if the taxpayers are paying for it, to see them use those dollars wisely. But here, you kind of start to run down that rabbit hole of how much regulation do you want to have? And how do you enforce that? How do you, you know, that per diem's given out, I believe, on their payroll, just after they have spent the money, their own money, it's a reimbursement per diem. So how would you enforce that? How would you do it? Good luck.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people who are against this legislation, the so-called, junk food stamps bill, are really upset with Democrats for voting for this. Well, Democrats argued on the floor about, restricting the amount of money that could be used for certain types of food, and especially foods like cheese, cheddar cheese, and craisins made in Wisconsin. They still voted for this, Daryl Mayfield. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised. I think that, as Owen said earlier, Dems sometimes have an issue in parsing political debate. One of the issues that they may have bought into, and I don't know, but they may have bought into, is, as Owen said, the First Lady's program in schools. Schools present a very different opportunity, I think, for a society and for a community, and that is the teaching of those things that are reasonable, teaching of those things that basically one could go out and test and bring back data. And so if we look at that and we talk about what certain foods do, foods high in carbohydrates as opposed to other types of foods, sugary foods, then we want to teach individuals at an early age that it would be better for you health-wise to choose these foods most of the time and only choose snacks some of the time. I think it's something that most of us attempt to teach our kids. It's quite a different thing, however, to parse a situation where a legislator is being paid for his or her services and then passing regulation, which you probably can't regulate anyway, that they will only use their money when they're buying food outside of their home or for consumption maybe in their home. They'll only buy certain foods. The other part of, I think, as I said, the issue with food stamps is a solution-seeking of problem. There's a false belief that large numbers of people are purchasing foods that are not healthy. And I think the issue of brown eggs, sharp cheddar, organic milk not being on the list or being described as junk food clearly shows, as Owen said, the introduction or the pressure that special interest groups can put on legislators.
Let's go back to the phones. Saeed in Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm going to change the subject to the issue of additional funding for education in our state, which I applaud any investment in education. However, Albert Einstein once said that to do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, is a definition of insanity. And when we look at how much we spend inflation-adjusted dollars per student in our country over the last 40 years, we have more than tripled that investment. However, the outcomes have not improved at all. Reading achievement scores, math scores, graduation rates have stayed flat or reduced. And so we need to invest more in education, of course, but we can't do it the same old way that we've always done.
Yeah, so
we have to.
Invest in education, but not in terms of sending money per student in public schools.
Exactly.
So send that. How do you invest in education then?
Create competition.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at the educational system in the United States, we simultaneously have the best in the world and the worst in the world. The best in the world is our colleges.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Saeed. So, Daryl, maybe more money to private voucher schools, and that's how you should invest in education.
I understand what Saeed means by competition, but he also said that within the structures that we currently have, we have the best and we have the worst. Our challenge is to have more of the best and fewer of the worst. Now, I think what that means is, and what we're looking at, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal came up with a plan where they were going to take pretty much all of the public school funding in the state of Louisiana and create and give it to charter schools and other schools because that was going to increase competition. The problem with charter and voucher schools is the same problem that we have with public schools, and Saeed said that. We've spent money, and we know we spent money, but we're not getting what we think we ought to get for it. So the question then becomes, why aren't we doing that, and how do we know we're not getting what we should be? Well, we're able to, at some point, measure some things, but we have no overall measure yet to tell us exactly what it is we should be tweaking. How do we make more of the best schools and fewer of the worst educational experiences? That's the challenge. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge.
Owen?
Well, I think Saeed brings up the point that I was alluding to earlier, and that there is this false assumption that spending more on something means investing in it or means that you care more about it. And we see this in the budget debates where if we're going to raise the limit $100 per student or $200 per student, it becomes a competition on the more you spend that's perceived as the more you care. And I think that's a false assumption. I think that by and large, there are very, very few Wisconsinites who don't truly care about the education of our kids. And because it is a bedrock thing that we have to accomplish and accomplish well for the betterment of our state moving into the future. And many of us have kids in the school systems that, we're all passionate about it. We have different ideas about how to accomplish that. And I think that something we've seen in Wisconsin is there was a reduction in spending in education in the last cycle. We haven't seen declines in performance. You know, as Saeed said, we've tripled our real dollar investment in education over the past several decades with very little change in outcomes or actually decline in some outcomes. And at the same time, we have not yet had the school districts and the school boards around the state still have not yet taken full advantage of the tools that Act 10 put in their hands to be able to craft their schools better. And I'll applaud my own local school district here in West Bend, where they're beginning a charter school in the next year that's already full, that filled up right away. They're working on different outcomes, different educational programs that frankly weren't available to them before Act 10 and able to. But we haven't seen that come to fruition yet. So to continue just to throw more money into the districts, assuming that that's going to result in better outcomes, again, we've tried that time and time again. It doesn't work. We need other solutions beyond just throwing more money at it.
Well, we need to move on to some other topics. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or WEDEC, the state's beleaguered jobs creation agency, which was found to be having all sorts of problems and mismanagement, according to a recent audit, would have to meet several new requirements before getting any more money to operate. The Joint Finance Committee approved these provisions yesterday. So WEDEC would not get any money in the second year of the state budget until it proved that improvements have been made. This coming after the audit showed it did not follow state law or track loans that it handed out. So, Owen, your take on WEDEC's troubles?
Well, I like your characterization of beleaguered. I think that's accurate. This is obviously an organization that has struggled to get off the ground. It's only 2 years old, but have clearly had some poor management and some poor outcomes. And I'll go back to outcomes again. We're not getting the outcomes out of this agency that we expected. And frankly, I'd like to see more of this from the legislature, of taking some more direct oversight. They do control the budget. They do control the dollars. And I think it's perfectly well within their responsibility as a co-equal branch of government to say, hey, look, WEDEC, you're not doing what you're supposed to do. We're not getting the performance out of this agency we want. And at the same time, it's clear that your internal policies and procedures and all are not up to snuff. So get your act together or you don't get any more money. And I think that's a perfectly valid role, and I'm glad the Joint Finance Committee did that.
Are you too, Daryl?
I think that what the Joint Finance Committee is doing is a good administrative idea. I think historically, if you look back, not just at WEDEC, but if you look back at the Wisconsin Commerce Department, that you would have to say in the last several years, that particular organization prior to Governor Walker coming in and creating the WEDC, went through in about 4 years, it went through about four directors. That was a signal that there is an issue in terms of what the Wisconsin Commerce Department was supposed to be doing. So then the governor comes along, and what he does is he creates a new agency. He puts in individuals who are not used to working, not only not in the former organization. And I think the first signal was that there were questions about funds released by the agency that it could not account for. The governor is came from a background as a county, as an administrator. He knows that that's priority number one, that you be able to account for public funds. That it was put together and worked in a fast pace to get it up and started. I mean, that's not a professional answer for what the analysis revealed. Audits of the Wisconsin Economic Development Department were routine, and staffers did a good job of keeping their eye on the ball and contracts performing work. So there were some things that were basically already in place that you would think would simply have transferred over. Obviously, they did not, and we're at a situation where this beleaguered part of the administration's overall structure is having a problem.
Yeah, last weekend, in Wausau was the State Republican Convention. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss used the opportunity to reaffirm the party's commitment to voter ID. Let's take a listen.
Our agenda includes election reform because we promise that election reform led by voter ID will be in place for the 2014 elections.
So I know, Daryl Mayfield, this is an important issue to you. What do you make of Robin Voss saying voter ID will be in place for the 2014 elections?
Again, this is a Republican convention that's held in the largest county in the state and held in a county that traditionally has voted Republican. this is nothing more than red meat for the base, okay? IDs again, a solution seeking a problem. And I've been on your show as well as on other shows to talk about that. So when throwing out the IDs, the vouchers, again, I mentioned earlier that Governor Bobby Jindal's plan in Louisiana was basically struck down by Louisiana courts, that he could not give away public funding to voucher or charter schools. It doesn't say that voucher charter schools are a bad idea. What it says is a bad idea is to take public funding and give it and allow only or perhaps a situation where no one is reporting, there are no ways to measure what is being done. It's not a good thing to give public money to those types of things. So I'm not surprised by the gentleman announced. I mean, what else are you going to say? But I guess everybody is looking for or waiting for us to have a true two-party system where we can actually weigh ideas. And perhaps on either side, that's not happening.
Well, does election reform, should election reform be a priority of the Republicans, Owen?
I do think it should be, and I think voter ID in particular is something that still continues to enjoy overwhelming public support because it is just common sense. You're going in, you're exercising your franchise. It's something that we should encourage people to do. At the same time, we want to make sure that the people voting are supposed to be voting, that they are citizens and in the correct community, and they are who they say they are, and that they are voting properly. And given that the overwhelming majority of people already have an ID, this isn't a big deal. I do think that, you know, measures have to be taken to make sure that those who don't have an ID can get one easily and cheaply to make sure that we're not disenfranchising anybody. But at the same time, I think it's a very common sense measure and something that I believe right now the voter ID law is sitting waiting for the Supreme Court to take action. I've heard rumblings that there will be legislative action perhaps in a few months to go ahead and change that law as it's written a bit to account for some of the court's concerns. But I think there's a way to do it that's fair to everybody and that can help help make our elections more secure.
We are talking about
the courts have said that the bills that have come forth in terms of voter ID in most of the states have been struck down by the courts because, in fact, they are not fair to everybody. Mr. Hermaning and I had a discussion about this on another show on WPR. And again, when asked, where is the evidence that basically shows individuals are voting, there are voting irregularities that are basically because of fraud, there are none. And so, again, we have a solution that's seeking a problem. Walter Chilson, a former senator here in Wisconsin, whom I was on a program with, who is also a Republican, says the same thing. More red meat for the base. Let's just continue to push this idea. Let's continue to have subterfuge as opposed to dealing with real issues.
Let me take our break. We are talking with Daryl Mayfield, instructor of business ethics, diverse cultures, and other courses at Upper Iowa University in Wausau, and Owen Robinson, columnist at the West Bend Daily News, blogger at bootsandsabers.com. We will talk about other national and international issues in the news coming up. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's time for our Week in Review quiz. President Obama mixed golf with politics this week in an effort to advance his second term agenda through a better relationship with Congress. But afterward, it was Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss who was the talk of Washington. What rare feat did he pull off during the outing? That's the Week in Review question. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to guess. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What rare feat did Senator Saxby Chambliss accomplish on his recent golf outing with President Obama? We will randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will be entitled to one of the books that we have featured on the program recently. We'll announce the answer and the winner at the end of the show. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Owen Robinson and Daryl Mayfield. And let's talk about a number of national issues. Minnesota is poised to become the 12th state in the nation to approve gay marriage following a 75-59 vote in Minnesota's House yesterday. The Senate is expected to sign on it next week. Is Minnesota getting it right, Daryl Mayfield?
Well, the people are typically ahead of the politicians. So in that respect, I think you look at what will possibly happen in Minnesota, and there should be no surprise, I think.
Owen?
Yeah, I agree, and I believe that the governor has already said he will sign off on that. I think we continue to see this press across the states, and we'll continue to see it happen.
All right, well, let's talk about a hearing that was held this week in Congress. We had a hearing on the Benghazi attack, and Owen Robinson, are Republicans just trying to make political hay out of this, trying to make Hillary Clinton's poll numbers go down so she's not going to be as an attractive of candidate for president in 2016? That's what Democrats say.
Well, I think that's what the Democrats want to say because they don't want to talk about the issue itself. It's a very easy deflection to say, oh, that's all just politics, so don't pay attention. But this is a very serious issue. We had four Americans die, and it became clear from the testimony that they knew on day one that this was a coordinated terrorist attack. They refused to send in help, and they went out and lied about it for well over a week, including Ambassador Rice on national television, spinning this yarn about it being a spontaneous uprising in response to a video. That was clearly a lie, and they knew it from the outset. So the fact that we have high-level administration officials that were lying to the American public weeks before a national election, I think, is absolutely disgraceful.
Daryl?
I think what's disgraceful is better than 5,000 Americans have lost their lives in just Iraq alone. The thousands that have been wounded, let alone the millions of Iraqis that have been displaced. But no one has been called to account for weapons of mass destruction. Let's say exactly what this is, that any time an American life is lost, that we owe that citizen, his family or her family, to find out, to know exactly what it is that happened. But currently the discussion that revolves around Benghazi is all about if. There have been no facts that have come forward as of yet by the individuals who were there, who the Congress, the special committee, has chosen to basically have them come and testify. Let's see it out. Let's see if facts actually come out before we say that people have lied, that people have refused to basically send aid. Let's just see what the facts are and get beyond if.
Yeah. I mean, Owen, what is... What is the point of this? The point is that the Republicans think there was some sort of cover-up, that the Democrats, the administration, did not want to send aid to the Benghazi embassy?
I think it's pretty clear at this point that there was a cover-up. And the fact that you have high-ranking legislative officials like Speaker Boehner, who had seen emails that were sent within days after the attack, clearly indicating it was a terrorist attack, that we informed the Libyan ambassador that it was a terrorist attack. We had intelligence to that effect. And then for days after that, for Ambassador Rice to go on TV and tell an entirely different story, that's where you saw Gregory Hicks, who was testifying, saying he was embarrassed and ashamed by that testimony because he knew it was a lie at the time. And I think that, you know, when you talk about politicalization, if I could say that word, when you have the administration who's up for re-election weeks before the election trying to change the story away from the truth around this incident, that's a disgraceful act. And what I think that Republicans are looking for is some accountability here, for some understanding that there are people at the State Department. I think you even saw Secretary of State Kerry come out, and he's assigned a high-ranking official to look into this more. These are serious issues regarding national security and how we treat our ambassadors abroad, how we deal with terrorism, and the fact that it was covered up for weeks to get us past a national election, is we need some accountability.
Darryl?
You know, Owen has used pejorative words, cover up, people have lied. And yet the American system of government says that we have to go through a process to find out whether or not that has happened. This is part of that particular process. It's interesting that Owen also said that Mr. Boehner has seen, knows of, has read emails, but yet Mr. Boehner is not one of the three individuals that are being called to testify. Let's see what the individuals who have been called to testify, who know about the issue, can present the facts that basically tell us whether or not the Obama administration not only knew it was a terrorist attack, but they knew it was going to happen. Now, that's a key point, knowing that it's going to happen, as opposed to it's already happening, people are shooting, we have to now decide what plan A or plan B and whether or not we put that into action based on either information that we have, information that can be corroborated. Everyone, it seems, at this particular point is an armchair quarterback of how we could have won the game. Let's find out what the facts are.
Well, let's move on to yet another issue that's facing the United States. The White House this week said that Syrian President Assad has to go, saying that Syria's future cannot include President Assad. And the Obama administration announced $100 million in new humanitarian aid to the opposition. What should the U.S. role be in the civil war in Syria, Darryl Mayfield? Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a civil war in Syria. The question to be asked, if you really want to analyze the situation, is, what should have Britain, France, or Spain's position have been when the American Civil War happened? Now, there's some things that have happened within the area, pretty much the U.S.'s hands, perhaps, and other than in terms of humanitarian aid, are tied in regards to what options are available because of fallout from Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't think anybody in the United States right now wants to actually get into another Middle East war. It would not be responsible to intervene when you don't know with whom we're actually helping. History has shown that when we helped the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, a little later they morphed into the individuals that we end up fighting because we provided them with ground-to-air missiles to basically deter the attacks that were being brought on them by the Russians. Additionally, our complicated policy stand on Israel, its settlement policy vis-a-vis Palestinians, further restricts U.S. options for actions. So we have an issue, and maybe right now the best way to address it is what the Obama administration has done, and that is to relieve suffering of those in that country that we can through humanitarian aid.
Owen.
Well, I think there's two questions there, Joy, and I think one is the question you ask, which is, what should we do in Syria? The other question is, what are we doing? I'll start with the first one. I agree a lot with what Darryl said. I don't see an American interest in getting involved in a Syrian civil war. Bearing in mind that this is a region where they border significant United States allies in Turkey, Israel, Iraq, almost Jordan down there, in Turkey in particular, where we have a key American military base there that's critical to that region. So I think if we see that war start to spread, and we saw a little bit of that last week with weapons allegedly being shipped to Hezbollah, to Syria, and Israel taking action and striking that weapons cache and whatnot. So we see a little bit of that spreading. I think if we see much more of that, we're going to be forced by some of our treaties with some of our allies over there to come to their defense. But I don't really see an American interest in getting directly involved in that civil war for many of the reasons that Daryl stated. But what I also see is an administration that has a very confused policy right now that I don't think anybody really understands what it is. I mean, at first we had the bright red line about the chemical weapons. They crossed that. We didn't do anything. We're going to send $100 million in humanitarian aid, but we're not going to provide weapons. Even in the statements in the past couple days, Obama saying that President Assad can't be part of Syria moving forward, and then Kerry, the Secretary of State, turning around and saying, well, that's really up to the Syrian people. So I think we have a very unclear foreign policy around Syria right now that nobody can really figure out.
Let me move to another. Let me jump in because we're so short on time and we have other issues that we need to touch on. Let's talk about President Obama being in Texas yesterday talking about jobs and the economy. He says that the American economy is poised for progress, considering that the housing markets are improving, corporate profits are skyrocketing, energy and auto industries are thriving. The Dow this week closed above 15,000 for the first time ever. Daryl, briefly, is the economy poised to come back?
That's what Mr. Obama said is political fluff. Okay, I understand as the leader of the country, he has to and should give an optimistic view, and hopefully a realistic optimistic view of where we are. What's the takeaway for employment in terms of the Dow being at 15,000? You know, it seems to be no connection to Main Street or jobs or correlate to jobs. You know, is there some private-public partnership that's going to come out of all of the Dow being at 15,000 of the companies making the money that they're making? Are we ever going to get back to some idea of full employment? So that's nothing more than politics, and it's practiced by politicians.
Yeah. All right. Owen, your thoughts?
Yep, and I agree with Daryl. There's a lot of fluff there. You see the American workforce is smaller than it's been in decades as people are leaving the workforce and finding other things to do. We've seen more people go on disability and join food stamps than we have seen get jobs under the Obama administration. So there's a lot of fluff there, and we're seeing Obama do what Obama does. He can't get anything through Congress that he wants. He gets frustrated, so he goes out campaigning. That's all this is.
All right, time to congratulate Luke. He is the winner of our Week in Review quiz. We asked, what rare feat did Senator Saxby Chambliss accomplish on his recent golf outing with President Obama? The answer, a hole-in-one. It reportedly happened on the fifth hole at Andrews Air Force Base. He says he's the luckiest guy in the world. That hole-in-one led him and fellow Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee to victory over President Obama and his partner, Senator Mark Udall of Utah, who Golf Digest, by the way, says is the top-ranked golfer in Congress, or at least he was. So there we go, hole-in-one. Daryl, I don't know if you're a golfer or not, but any political figure you want to go golfing with?
And you can never rule out luck. It's always better to be lucky than to be good, I guess.
All right, but Owen, are you have you ever had a hole in one?
I have not, and not much of a golfer, but it's always nice to get outside.
All right, thanks both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Owen Robinson, columnist at the West Bend Daily News. Daryl Mayfield, instructor of business ethics, diverse cultures, and other courses at Upper Iowa University in Wausau. By the way, on Monday, it's our State Capitol Report. Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter Sean Johnson will join us. He will have more on the budget surplus, Wedick's troubles, and other news in state politics. That's coming up on our State Capitol Report, Monday morning after 7. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Robin Cherry for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. Have a good weekend. This is the Ideas Network.